The agent of the next catastrophe, they knew, would almost certainly be a virus. Not a bacterium, as with bubonic plague, not some brain-eating fungus, not an elaborate protozoan of the sort that caused malaria. No, a virus. And more specifically, it would be a novel virus.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with David Quammen, author of Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. It's an in-depth scientific look at the coronavirus pandemic that swept and is still sweeping the globe. Breathless is a book that questions the virus's origins. It is, as many of David's books are, an origin story. David has appeared on The Right Question many times, including an appearance in a special program that aired in April of 2020 in partnership with Humanities Montana. That episode is available online, and in it, David speaks with Humanities Montana's Samantha Dwyer about his work during and considering the COVID-19 pandemic. I strongly encourage listeners to listen to that conversation either before or after this one. At the time of my conversation with David, Breathless had been shortlisted for the National Book Award for Nonfiction. David, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you very much, Lauren. Great to be talking with you again.
I read on your website, David, that your publisher, Simon & Schuster, were the folks or were the ones to ask you to write Breathless. Did you give them an immediate yes when they asked, or did you have reservations about writing a book about the coronavirus pandemic? I'm wondering about that process for you.
Right. I thought very carefully about it for 4 or 5 seconds before I said yes. And I thought about it because one of my operating principles is write books about things that other people aren't writing books about. And the second operating principle is go there. If you're writing about disease in gorillas in the Congo, go there. If you're writing about bats carrying viruses in caves in southern China, go there. And that's the sort of thing I did while researching my previous book, Spillover, published in 2012, about the whole general subject of animal viruses that spill over into humans. So when Simon & Schuster asked me about this, I was facing those two reservations, but I realized that this was not an opportunity. This was a responsibility. This was a duty. And I should figure out some way to do this book. So I said, yes, definitely. I will write you a book about the pandemic. And then I had to figure out how to do that, what kind of a book to write and how to research it. And it took me essentially the rest of 2020 to answer those questions. And I began in the very first days of 2021, working on it.
You used the word responsibility, and I kind of want to go back to that idea. There are so many voices in this book, and you end the book. I'm going to go, kind of skip to the end just really briefly. You end the book by saying that the world needs to hear many voices and perspectives to help one another understand what has happened and what will continue to happen. But I'm wondering what it feels like for you to be a leading voice in this conversation, specifically around the coronavirus. The world now looks to you, among many other researchers and scientists, but we look to you for information and guidance. And I'm curious how you choose to carry that weight. As you've said, it's a responsibility, but how it feels to carry that weight.
Well, it feels bizarre to be trusted like that, to have those expectations, to carry that weight. When I started as a writer, when I published my first book, which is 52 years ago.
Oh, wow.
It was a novel, and I thought I was going to be a novelist. And I had no inkling that I would end up writing books about science, the life sciences, let alone books about viruses. I had no inkling that I would turn into a nonfiction writer at all, but I did. And I did essentially while I was living there in Missoula, or at least part of the process occurred there. But now I find myself channeling experts in infectious disease science and in virology. And I am very clear in my mind that I am not an expert. I've been essentially writing this book for 20 years. I've been following this beat for 20 years, a little bit more than that. But I'm not trained as a scientist, let alone as a molecular evolutionary virologist. I just listen very hard, very carefully to the people who are the experts. And I do a lot of reading of scientific journals, and I check my facts, and I tell the general reader what those people are thinking, doing, and saying. And so it is a responsibility that has come to me as a surprise, but it feels like a privilege to, in a sense, to have that responsibility.
The COVID-19 pandemic is unique in myriad ways, but it occurred to me while reading your book that our information technologies, our communication technologies have so vastly changed, certainly in the 20 years that you've been on this beat, as you say, but, you know, since 2003 during the SARS outbreak, since 2013 through 2016, you know, the Ebola outbreaks. I mean, that the way the world communicates has so vastly changed and quickened its pace in that time. You know, news travels faster and more quickly. And I think Breathless touches on this idea, but perhaps doesn't go into it super explicitly. How did the pace of such technologies, right? You've got the internet, you've got social media, you have all of these new technologies. How did that pace help? And in some cases, and you do touch on these in the book, hinder, you know, the search for this coronavirus's origin and subsequently its containment?
Well, you're right that everything has speeded up, certainly over the last 20 years since I got interested, 22 years since I got interested first in Ebola virus. We're much more connected by way of the internet, by way of email, by way of social media on the internet. And science is more instantaneously connected too. So I would point to a couple of things. And these things were already beginning to be very important back in 2014, when the large and alarming Ebola epidemic in three West African countries began. So I had already had this taste of getting calls and emails from around the world saying, will you help us understand this virus? 2014 Ebola, now 2020, this what became SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus. More and more people are going to the internet now for information, doing what they think of as research, which means typing a few words into a search engine and then being somewhat credulous about whatever comes up. That has become a severe problem and has had great effect, confusing, accelerating, obfuscating effect on what people think they know, for instance, about the origins. There have been other things that have speeded up. Social media, Twitter. There is a lot of really wacky stuff that flies around on Twitter. But there's also science. The scientists, many of them, have been using Twitter as one tool to communicate with one another, posting provisional thoughts, announcing their papers, and announcing their papers before the papers have quite become published journal papers. And that's a third thing that has changed. Preprints that are in submission to reputable peer-reviewed scientific journals, but which now very frequently are posted online at a number of different sites before they have been peer-reviewed, as a draft offered as a preprint, saying to the world, this is what we think. This is a draft of our paper. We have submitted it to journals such as Nature or Science or the Journal of Virology. It's in review at those places. But in the meantime, because this is such an urgent situation, we want to tell the world what we think we know. And so these preprints have gone up. And that's been very important. And that's been both good and bad. Some of those preprints have delivered enlightenment much more quickly to the public and to other scientists than the peer review publication process through scientific journals can do, because that's very slow. It takes months, and sometimes it can take years. Preprints are right now. But some of those preprints that have gone up have have not stood scrutiny. And people have immediately been able to point out mistakes. People who think they knew things about this virus posted preprints. For instance, this looks like a virus that must have come from snakes. That was one thing that went up very early on in 2020. Or there was another preprint that said, well, this virus looks like it has insertions in it of certain bits of genetic code that seem to have come from the AIDS virus, HIV-1. That didn't stand scrutiny either. So those preprints were taken down in embarrassment and never did appear as scientific journal articles. Other preprints went up quickly, cast real light on the subject, even though they might not have been perfect yet, and then went through the review process. In some cases were tweaked, were amended, were revised somewhat, were strengthened, and now have been published as journal articles in Science, Nature, Journal of Virology, wherever. So all of those things are relatively new. Not entirely new since 2014, but certainly new since 1999, when I first got interested in writing about Ebola virus.
You have and had a long history of studying viruses by the time, you know, you came to Breathless. I'm wondering if there was anything that knocked your socks off. Like, what surprised you most in all of these conversations with people that you'd talked to before, people that you were just meeting over Zoom? What surprised you most in the research process of this book?
Of this book? I think the thing that surprised me most was how unprepared we were, how constrained the scientists are by politics and funding. The scientists knew things and offered warnings that weren't heeded. My second chapter, as you know, is titled The Warnings. And I trace both the long-term warnings over the last 20 years or so about single-stranded RNA viruses being likely to produce the next pandemic, and the more immediate warnings that we're telling people for some years that coronaviruses in particular could be dangerous, that there were coronaviruses circulating in bats that had the potential to infect humans and possibly transmit. So I knew those things, but I didn't realize how difficult it was to get public health uptake and political uptake on the things that the scientists knew.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with David Quammen. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. If you want to listen to this conversation again or share it with friends, it can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Because we are at a very deliberate break in our conversation, I'm wondering if you might read an excerpt from Breathless.
So this is the very beginning of the book, the beginning of section one. To some people, it wasn't surprising, the advent of this pandemic, merely shocking in the way a grim inevitability can shock. Those unsurprised people were infectious disease scientists. They had for decades seen such an event coming, like a small dark dot on the horizon of Western Nebraska, rumbling toward us at indeterminable speed and with indeterminable force, like a runaway chicken truck or an 18-wheeler loaded with rolled steel. The agent of the next catastrophe, they knew, would almost certainly be a virus. Not a bacterium, as with bubonic plague, not some brain-eating fungus, not an elaborate protozoan of the sort that caused malaria. No, a virus. And more specifically, it would be a novel virus, meaning not new to the world, but newly recognized as infecting humans. But if new to humans, from where would a novel virus emanate? Good question. Everything comes from somewhere, and new viruses in humans come from wild animals, sometimes by way of a domestic animal as intermediary. Such viruses, including Marburg and rabies and Lassa and monkeypox, cause afflictions that are termed zoonoses, or zoonotic diseases. Most human infectious diseases are zoonotic, caused by animal origin pathogens that reach us repeatedly, Nipah virus spilling over from fruit bats in Bangladesh, or have reached us in the past, HIV group M, the pandemic AIDS subtype spilling over from a chimpanzee once. Some are old to us, the plague bacterium, yellow fever virus, and hatefully familiar. Some are as startlingly new and ferocious, Ebola virus, as a predatory alien in a movie. A novel virus can be devastating if we have no vaccines to deflect it, no drugs to fight it, no history of past exposure to anything similar that might give us acquired immunity. These scientists, the ones schooled in infectious diseases and savvy to zoonoses, further foresaw that it would likely be a particular kind of virus causing the next pandemic, a virus with a certain kind of genome, allowing for speedy evolution, a capacity to change, adapt fast. That genome would be written in RNA, not DNA. That is, a single-strand informational molecule, rather frangible, not DNA's double helix. Never mind for now just what RNA is, how it works, or why a single-stranded RNA genome can be especially changeable and adaptive. Suffice to say that such speedy adapters include the influenzas and the coronaviruses. In the years before 2019, the word coronavirus was unfamiliar to most people, but it already carried an ominous timbre to infectious disease scientists.
Not only is this book a deep dive into the science around COVID, it's also an introduction to the many different researchers and scientists who were and are behind the scenes of this work. And you go to great lengths to talk about each person, their background, their education, their career trajectories. And you also include biographies of these scientists, you know, as credits at the end of the book. And I think Breathless would have been a completely different book had you eliminated the human, the people aspect of it. I'm wondering what your thought process was behind including such detailed portraits of those scientists in the book.
Yes, let's talk about that. I mentioned earlier that by the end of 2020, I had an idea. Aha, I have a concept for how to do this book. I can't travel. I can't go into caves in China with scientists. I can't walk through jungles in the Congo with scientists the way I've done in the past. And I want to write a book that's different from the other books that are going to be written about this medical crisis, about this public health catastrophe. So what I decided was I would write a book about the virus. The virus would be my main character. I would write it about the origin, evolution, and fierce journey of this virus through the human population, and about the scientists who study it. And I decided that I would do extended Zoom interviews with 60 or 70 of the world's leading virologists, the world's leading experts, epidemiologists, virologists, molecular biologists on this area. And it turned out to be 95 once I got going. But I thought at the first, I'll do 60 or 70 of these long interviews, an hour and a half each. And I will ask each person about his or her work on the virus, his or her thoughts, views of the virus, its origins, its evolution, but also about his or her life as a person during the pandemic, as a teacher, as well as a scientist, as a daughter or a son of possibly elderly parents, of a parent to young children. I interviewed, as I said, 95 people. I considered them my Greek chorus, these voices. And I wanted to present them not just as scientists, but as human beings. Because I wanted to make the point, among other points, that as important as science is in dealing with this virus and this pandemic, science is always provisional. It's always an incremental movement toward clearer and more accurate understanding of the dynamics of the physical world. It also involves ambition, competition, in some cases grudges, in some cases the rush for priority to make a career, to get credit. It involves all those things, as well as the extreme dedication to truth and accuracy that you find in the best of scientists. So I wanted to get that in there. I wanted this to be a book, to, in some extent, about the scientific process and about these people, as well as about the virus. And so I asked them about their personal lives. And as you said, after I tell the story of this virus as a breathless narrative, at the end, I have a section that I call credits, which consists of a longish paragraph about each of my 95 sources saying things for which there was no proper place in the breathless narrative, saying things about them, in some cases repeating anecdotes that they told me, or mentioning funny things that they said that were humanizing but not strictly relevant. For instance, Tony Fauci, I asked him at the end of our interview, after this very serious and genial but focused interview, I said at the end, okay, just one more question, Dr. Fauci. Who does the best Tony Fauci imitation? Is it Brad Pitt or Kate McKinnon? And we were on Zoom and he kind of tilted back his head and he laughed and he said, ah, you know, and I won't do his accent. I won't try.
Yeah, that's not.
He said, you know, I was thrilled when Brad Pitt got nominated for an Emmy for impersonating me on Saturday Night Live. But Kate McKinnon, she is so talented. He loved what Kate McKinnon did. So that obviously was not going to fit into the narrative, or at least not in this book, because this book is shorter than some of my other books. And I meant it to have a driving, pulsing momentum moving through the events like a freight train. But I wanted to give credit to these scientists who had given me their time and their trust and their thoughts. So, and some of them I didn't even mention in the book. I talked to a lot of people that never fit into the narrative, but they helped to educate me.
I love that you talk about science and research as provisional. How I hear that is that it's revision-based, right? You are trying something out. You're going back to the drawing board if it doesn't work out, which means that, you know, a lot of these researchers, these scientists, they were studying coronavirus and, you know, testing their theories and going back to the drawing board, as I said, if it didn't work out. I guess I want to make two points, or one point and one question. The first point being that the science as a discipline kind of seems so much like writing in that way, this revision-based discipline. You know, we're not always getting it right at first, but we're going back. You know, scientists have peer reviewers. They're working with other researchers in collaboration. Often writers are working with editors. I thought that was like a very beautiful kind of parallel that came out of the book that wasn't said explicitly. But the question I have maybe goes back to this human idea. These researchers are human. They are making mistakes in some instances. How does Breathless confront ideas of blame?
Well, I'm not interested in blame because I think blame distracts us from understanding. So my approach to the various different voices in this book, for one instance, on the question of the origins of the virus, and I go into that, and I talk about the different, what I call the different schools of thought, two main schools of thought, the natural origins school of thought and the nefarious origins school of thought. And the nefarious origins school of thought encompasses the idea that it was an engineered virus intentionally created to do harm and intentionally released upon the world. And also the idea that, no, it was a virus that might have originated in the wild, but it was manipulated in the laboratory for scientific purposes, possibly good purposes, but then because of sloppiness, it leaked from a laboratory. Or maybe it was just a virus taken from the wild, not manipulated, but leaked from a laboratory. I take those ideas quite seriously, and I try and treat them with fairness. Does that mean the question is settled? No, it's not quite settled. There is a possibility, and I don't think it's a very large possibility, but I agree that there is a possibility that lab leak might have been the origin of the virus. Maybe, you know, if you had to put a number on it, maybe 1% or 2% possibility and 98 or 99% likelihood that natural origins is correct. But science is provisional. And until we have absolute nail in the coffin proof of the natural origins hypothesis, we should recognize that it is the best provisional explanation that we have. Just as the explanations of the universe and the physical motions in the universe as presented by Isaac Newton in the 17th century and by Galileo were the very best that we had at the time, and they have been improved on since then. But in principle, they have been confirmed. But let's talk a little bit more about writing and science. When I write nonfiction, I gather facts. I research for a couple of years, or in some cases, I research for 3 or 4 years or more. This case, I researched breathlessly for 6 months, but I had a long running start. I'm gathering voices. I'm interviewing people. I'm recording their interviews, and or I'm taking notes. And I want verbatim speech. When in this case, I did 95 Zoom interviews, so I could have those transcribed. I recorded them, and my trusted transcriber transcribed them as she has transcribed interviews for me for 30 years. And I gather other facts from reading the journal papers and other sources. And those facts are particulate and sacred, as far as I'm concerned. Just the way data are sacred to a scientist. You gather data, you look for patterns in data, you make sense of those patterns, you interpret those patterns, but you don't violate the integrity of those data. You don't change those data. And so that's parallel to the way I feel about, not just about facts that come from journal papers, but about quotes that come from interviews. I don't scribble paraphrases in my notebook and then turn those into spoken speech in quotation marks when I write. I don't improve quotes. And if somebody commits a grammatical error, in a lot of cases, I keep it in. I treat verbal statements from sources as something that should be as accurate as the data that scientists use when they compose their theories.
That's a good place to stop. I think that makes sense. David, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome, Lauren. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the conversation.
That was David Quammen, author of Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus, out now from Simon & Schuster. Look for more information about David, including his author bio, at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Brian Ramirez was the sound engineer for this episode. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.